Shell and I returned from regional conference when we were over in Portland. We went to Kennewick and on across. I would give my greetings to Kennewick being on the line, those on the cybercast. Came home Tuesday night, got to see a lot of friends and some of all of our friends as well. Glenn and Connie were there. Glenn broke his leg and is walking around with kind of an inflatable cast on. And so he looks like the way I picture the pirate in Peter Pan. You know, he's dragging one side as he walks. Earl and Carol Romer were there. Earl had new knees put in not too long back. And so he has a cane with four little feet on it, and he's hobbling around. And I got to thinking, well, you know, Michelle's knees have also been done. And she's doing pretty well. But, you know, the ministry just doesn't look as fresh as they used to. You go to the meetings, and Glenn drags up to give the prayer, and Earl hobbles up to get in line, and he would be mad at me if I made any more fun of him than that. But I just, like I say, we just don't look as fresh, and then I have to have Gail help me with my microphone. It's kind of embarrassing. The theme of the conference was developing spiritual maturity. And presentations were given on teaching, godly leadership, relationships, as in you ought to have some, be good. Bob Dick also gave a presentation on the lessons learned over the last 10 years. And he went back and he analyzed the changes that we have seen take place and the way that's affected our perspective. I thought that was a very, very interesting presentation. Bob Dick's very analytical. I went up to him afterwards and I said, you know, I just like the way you process and think. He goes through and he analyzes. He's very precise. And I enjoy that very much. He pointed out five things that we've learned in United, you know, in our circumstances. We've walked through these last 10 years. And it's interesting because Gail Allwine had given a sermonette that, to me, very closely related to one. Gail was talking about what it is that unites this world and what it is that should unite us. And many times this world is united in opposition to something. You know, you're for your team, but you're against the other team. And frankly, being against the other team is as much of a uniting factor as anything else. But what Bob Dick said in his presentation, one of the points he said, we learned that united against does not mean united for. And he was pointing out that as we came together and formed to try to go forward in that sense, we were all against what had taken place. But we found out that that didn't mean we were all for going in the same direction. And so then we went through a certain series of tumbles and circumstance ourselves. But it was a real interesting process to have him spell that out a little bit and maybe focus on some of those issues, analyze them in our own minds. He gave 5 points that we had learned. He gave 1 point that we were in the process of learning. I thought, well, okay, here's something we haven't arrived yet on. And he said, we're learning to handle our freedom, and specifically he referenced our freedom of expression. We're learning to disagree together. Now, that's an interesting concept when you think about that. See, there was a time in the Church of God when you could express your opinion as long as your opinion was pretty solidly in line with what the master opinion was, the overall concept. But if on a major issue you had a very strong disagreement, you know, that could have been something you would have had to simply keep to yourself. But he just said, we're learning to handle our freedom of expression. We're learning how to speak and to have the freedom to speak, but to not do so in such a way that causes injury or division. Spiritual maturity is both our relationship to God, the way we relate to God, but also the way we relate to each other. Spiritual maturity is loving God, but it's also loving our neighbor. And so in that sense, we can't afford to be walking around not looking quite as fresh as we used to be. We can't walk around spiritually dragging one leg or walking with our cane because we're not quite up to where we ought to be. So the fact is, as we sometimes deteriorate physically, we cannot afford to deteriorate spiritually, we must be indeed maturing and going the other way. No matter how weak we are in the flesh, we can be strong in the spirit. In fact, we must be. We must become spiritually mature. I think that's an important concept to be thinking about as we move into the holy days, as we come up to Passover and the days of unleavened bread. I mean, the purpose of those days is so that we would change and become more, as I was addressing last week, more Christ-like, more like God. It should have an impact on our lives. And we would call that impact maturity, spiritual maturity, having better understanding, more patience, stronger faith. Ephesians 4 has been used over the last years, probably more than I've ever referenced it in terms of thinking about the concept that is here in my days of this church. But Ephesians 4, verse number 11, is talking about spiritual maturity, and it's talking about the church as a whole coming into a stronger position before God in that way, to work together more and more. He himself gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers, or teaching pastors, for the equipping of the saints for the work of ministry. The word ministry basically means service. The equipping of the saints to be able to better serve one another and others. For the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come to the unity of the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man. When we were trying to identify spiritual maturity in the index and what we would put it under, one of the words that came out was perfect. And it means mature, in this case spiritually so. To the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. That we should no longer be children tossed to and fro, carried about with every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men and the cunning craftiness by which they lie in wait to deceive, but speaking the truth in love, not just speaking the truth, not just openly throwing it out like you would throw out the gauntlet. Speaking the truth in love may grow up in all things unto him who is the head, Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effective working by which every part does its share. If each of us is not personally invested, then we haven't arrived at this point. If we haven't bought in and we're not waiting to be told, but actually picking up and carrying it on our own desire, then we have not reached this point. According to the effective working by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body to the edifying of itself in love. So it's a description of the church coming to maturity spiritually before God. I mentioned recently as well that when Debbie had made comment in our speaking club and her philosophy that she strives to reach for and for which she looks to Scripture, but it says to be strong and to go forward. You know, I think be strong and go forward in a scriptural basis is another way of saying becoming spiritually mature. You can't look back, go back. You can't fix the past. You can only affect the present and go forward. You have to live for the future. To the degree that we live in the past is a degree that we probably deceive ourselves or prevent ourselves from going forward. I didn't have a chance to read any of the scriptural basis that she used for that, but I called and asked, and one of those scriptures was Joshua 1. And I want to read part of this, because we have here this transition. You could argue in that sense that the basis of Israel and their preparation was in the wilderness, but the time came when they were to put down roots and be fruitful and multiply in the sense of being in their land. And so Joshua now begins to give them their instructions, their marching orders in that sense. It says, after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, came to pass that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore, arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land that I am giving to them, the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I've given to you, as I said to Moses. From the wilderness, and it gives this description of the territory, but verse 5, no man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you. I think we also put that verse under encouragement. I will not leave you nor forsake you. Be strong and of good courage. You know, be strong. Go forward. The promised land is over there. For to this people you shall divide as an inheritance the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Don't turn to the left, don't turn to the right, so that I may prosper you, so that I can bless you where you go. There is no other way. We do not get blessed for being spiritually immature. We do not get rewarded for pulling up short. God says, be strong, but go forward. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, then you will have good success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid nor be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. You know, we ought to have that stamped indelibly into our minds, what God has said, indeed, given us to do. The hotel that we stayed at in Portland is the exact hotel that we were in 1991 on September 11th. You know, I remember waking up in my room with the phone ringing, and Rock Corbett calling says, you need to turn on your TV. It was September 11th, and again, the trade towers were in flames, and one was at least when we turned the TV on. And then we watched that whole scenario play out. You know, walking back into that hotel, into those rooms, into the same meeting rooms, it brought back some of the memories of what had taken place those recent previous years. What comes to my mind and heart is all the firemen and all the policemen who gave their lives trying to save others. And they didn't all die just trying to save some. Some of them died just trying to help others. I remember reading one story, I don't remember, I think it was a fireman, but there were people who were burnt and they were on one of the landings in the trade center, and the other one had gone down, and he could have got up and ran down the stairs and saved himself. He could have got out of the building, but he was taking care of people who could not. Now, he couldn't save them, but he died just simply giving them comfort and care. And I thought, how remarkable is that? He refused to escape and to abandon those people that he had begun to care for and to assist. And yet he couldn't take them with him. And they couldn't leave on their own. You can't tell a person to do that. They have to choose to do that. It's above and beyond the call of duty. And it's an important concept if we're going to understand what spiritual maturity is. Spiritual maturity is not doing what you're told. It's going above and beyond what you're told. It's the kind of behavior, at least in part, that they award the Medal of Honor for. There's a very specific category to people who fall in that line. In the military, the Medal of Honor is the highest medal that is given, the highest award, at least in our nation. It's for courage. But a particular type of courage. Again, the kind of courage that somebody cannot tell you that you must do. They do not give the Medal of Honor for following orders. You might have a concept that this person did what they had to. They did what they were told to, and everybody else didn't, and they're going to get the Medal of Honor, and that's not true. You don't get the Medal of Honor for following orders. You get it for going above and beyond your orders, for doing more than they can even tell you you should do. In fact, it's the kind of deed that if you were not to do it, you would not be criticized. If it was not for your act of valor, if you had simply walked away, there would be no criticism whatsoever because it could not have been expected of you. And then when you do it on your own, that's where consideration for that specific medal is given. It's an incredibly high standard. It's probably as high a standard as man has. Courage is expressed in different ways. I want to read a little bit of a reference here to Teddy Roosevelt, something that happened when he was running for election and campaigning. I think it's pretty remarkable. I've saved it over the years, and I think about it from time to time. Once in a while, I hear it referenced in the news. But it was October 14, 1912. Roosevelt was in Milwaukee campaigning for re-election to the presidency as a third-party candidate, kind of like we've had over years. Ross Perot ran 1 year, third-party candidate. He was actually running as a third-party candidate. On his way to making a speech, Roosevelt stood in an automobile, bowing to a cheering crowd, and suddenly a shot rang out. Half-crazed fanatic had shot the former president. They wanted to rush him to a hospital, and Roosevelt said, "Get me to the speech. It may be the last one that I shall deliver, but I will deliver it." As he entered the hall where he was to speak, someone explained, "Look, Colonel, there's a hole in your coat." Roosevelt looked down, saw the hole, and put his hand inside his coat, pulled his hand back out, covered in blood. He says, "It looks as though I've been hit." He says, "But I don't think it's anything serious." Three physicians summoned from the audience examined the wound, and the bullet was lodged near his right lung, and they recommended he be taken at once to the hospital, and Roosevelt would have none of it. Beginning his speech, he told the audience, "I'm going to ask you to be very quiet, and please excuse me from making a long speech. You see, there is a bullet in my body, but it is nothing. I'm not badly hurt." When he took the folded manuscript of the speech from his coat pocket, he saw that there was a bullet hole completely through it. The bullet first passed through a metal case for his eyeglasses, then through his speech text, and then was lodged next to his lung. Holding up the bullet-pierced speech manuscript to the crowd, Roosevelt roared, "It takes more than that to kill a bull moose." With a bloody handkerchief pressed on the wound, Roosevelt spoke for an hour and a half. Several times he seemed to weaken, but when persons on the platform rose to help him, he shook them off, saying, "Let me alone. I'm all right." Roosevelt finished his speech and was taken by special train to Chicago, arriving there 3:30 the next morning. Even then, he insisted on walking to the ambulance and into the hospital himself. Do you remember when President Reagan was shot? Do you remember how he got into the hospital? You know, he walked. Now, when he got through the door, he collapsed. But he walked into the hospital because he felt it was important that this nation see their president on his own feet. You know, I thought that was an incredible thing. He could have just said, "Take me in on the stretcher. I have been shot." He says, "I'm no weakling to be crippled by a flesh wound," the former Rough Rider declared. Roosevelt remained in the hospital until October the 21st, when returned to his suburban home in Oyster Bay, Long Island. 10 days later, he addressed an audience of 15,000 in New York City's Madison Square Garden. The shredded speech manuscript, the mangled spectacle case, the torn shirt he was wearing that day are on display where Theodore Roosevelt was born in New York City, a tribute to a stubborn and brave man. Now, think about that. Would anyone have criticized Teddy Roosevelt for just going on to the hospital after he was shot? No, if anything, they would have criticized him for speaking. So he could have said, "Look, all right, I got a bullet next to my lung. I think I'll go get healed, fixed. God heals, man, doctors assist." Nobody would have ever criticized him for that. And so when an action like that takes place, it's above and beyond what would be expected. It's a different category of action and commitment. 1 Samuel 17, example here from the Bible, of this kind of character and this kind of courage. 1 Samuel 17 and verse 32. Here we have the story of David and Goliath, one of the great stories in the Bible. We've all gone through it so many times. But they didn't have a champion to stand up to Goliath, and David came into the camp, and he couldn't believe that this giant was able to blaspheme against the God of Israel and get away with it. Verse 32. Again, look at this in terms of the type of courage that is displayed. David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." Saul said to David, "You're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him. You're but a youth, and he's a man of war from his youth. You don't measure up. You're just a kid. And this is a professional soldier and a giant." But David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep his father's sheep, and when a lion or bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it, delivered the lamb from its mouth, and when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard." You know what he's saying? He said, "I grabbed it with my fist, and I killed it." No, I didn't stand back and hit it with a howitzer, you know. Yeah, that's not. He said, I caught it by its beard and struck and killed it. He went in there and took it out face to face. That's unbelievable. "Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God." He's not saying I can take him out because I'm so great. He's saying God is with me. This will not stand against God. "Moreover," David said, "the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go and the Lord be with you." So Saul clothed David with his armor, put on a bronze helmet. I would have climbed into a Sherman tank or something, you know, buttoned down the lid and motored out on the battlefield. Put a bronze helmet on his head, clothed him with a coat of mail. David fastened a sword to his armor and tried to walk, for he had not tested them. I think sometimes we get the impression that David was still kind of small and kind of a runt, and he put this great big bunch of armor on because Saul was so large and he couldn't kind of get around in it. David was strong. He was agile. He may not have been as tall as Saul, but he was capable. But he just said, "I'm not used to this. I can't depend on this. I haven't tested this." And David said to Saul, "I can't walk with this. I've not tested him," and he took it off. So he walked out there kind of in his skin, going to go into battle against the soldier. And he took a staff in his hand. He chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook, put them in a shepherd's bag, and a pouch that he had, a sling in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. So the Philistine came, began drawing near to David, and the man who bore the shield went before him. When the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, because he was but a youth, ruddy and good-looking. I don't know why he disdained him, because he was good-looking. That shouldn't have been a problem. So the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come at me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, "Come to me, I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." And David said to the Philistine, "You come at me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin. I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied." Where do we get our confidence and our courage and our strength? Those who wait on the Lord will mount up as eagles. "I will send my angel with you and protect you. I will raise up the hands that are weary." You know, God reminds us that the strength that we receive comes from Him. "This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand. I will strike you and take your head from you. This day I'll give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air, the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." Figure out what it is that you have battle that lays before you. What fight do you face? You know, well, maybe we don't have the same money we need to have, or the same means, or the same connections, or the same education, or the same opportunity physically, but if indeed you're doing what you do by God's will and strength, then you can succeed and will, because he will be with you. And it was so when the Philistine arose, and this is the part that I like, and came and drew near to meet David, that David hastened and ran toward the army to meet this Philistine. He ran into battle. He didn't just kind of inch up, you know, and kind of going to be ready to dodge the spear. He just ran. I love that. But I tried to picture what David did. Then David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone, swung it, struck the Philistine in his forehead so that the stone sank into his forehead and he fell on his face to the earth. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, struck him and killed him. Now go back and ask yourself the very same question. David was younger than the other soldiers. He was not trained in the military arts of war. And if David would have said, you know what, I'm not going to go out there and fight that guy, would anyone have criticized him? None. They criticized him for going out to fight. But they would not have criticized him for drawing back. And so again, you have this quality of character that goes above and beyond what anybody would have expected him to do. That's the Medal of Honor. If you would not do it, then nobody would criticize you for not having done in that way. It's a particular, very, very high quality of character and courage. It is tempting to illustrate courage, and I mean courage in the sense of spiritual courage in our calling and responsiveness to God. It's tempting to illustrate courage mainly by action and strength. But if we did that, if we did just that, that would leave out most of us in the day-to-day lives that we live, would it not? Action and strength. We don't always feel that strong, and quite frankly, our daily lives are much more, at times, grinding and monotonous than that. So we certainly must have courage, and we certainly must be spiritually mature. How many of you went out this week and jumped over, leapt over tall buildings as you went through the day, you know, the Superman scenario? Some kinds of courage are more quiet. But again, the highest levels of that courage are still those things that go above and beyond what anyone would have expected you to do. Luke 21 is an example of the more quiet type of courage. As he looked and he saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury, and he saw also a certain poor widow putting in 2 mites. So he said, truly I say to you that this poor widow has put in more than all, for all these out of their abundance have put in offerings to God, but she out of her poverty has put in all the livelihood that she had. If a widow came to me, and she's about out of food, and maybe the rent's due, and she said, you know, I got this $20 left in my bank account, and I'm going to send it on in as an offering. I'd say, don't do it. Don't do it. You know, you saved the 20, and how can we help? Can we help? But I would not say, yeah, I think you need to do that. Take every last penny you got. Don't worry about the rent. Don't worry about food. Just send it in. You know, put my name on it. Send it to me. I wouldn't do that. This widow would not have been criticized if she said, you know, I don't think I can take the last couple of little pieces of coinage I've got and just put them in the box. Nobody would have criticized her for holding on to those 2 coins. What she did was the same kind of courage that David expressed in running out there to meet Goliath. The same courage. But she did it in a way that was along her experience and according to her circumstances in that day. Mary, done right, takes courage. You have to give it all that you have. Child rearing, done right, takes courage. Same principle. And if you're doing what's required, you're not doing enough, even by what would be exemplary before man. let alone before God. Unity takes courage. Forgiveness takes courage because you cannot hold anything back. If you hold it back, if you keep your last coin, you have not forgiven. And you will not go forward. You are not standing fast and going forward on toward the kingdom. Forgiveness comes from strength, not weakness. Sometimes we think, well, you know, that person needs to pay. Well, there needs to be an accounting of this. And to somehow turn the other cheek is seen as weakness, not strength. Well, that's a whole subject of its own. But I would just say this, the kind of strength that comes from forgiveness is not the strength of this flesh. It's the strength of God doing His work in us. And when God works in us, there is no way to go above and beyond that, because that is the ultimate option that there is. You do not get the Medal of Honor for obeying God. Obedience is what we are supposed to do. Luke 17, just going back a few chapters. Verse number 1. Jesus here said to his disciples, it's impossible that no offenses should come, but woe to him whom they come, through him whom they come. It'd be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck, thrown into the sea, he was thrown into the sea, than that he should offend one of these little ones. Take heed to yourselves. If your brother sins against you, rebuke him. If he repents, forgive him. If he sins against you 7 times in a day, and 7 times in a day returns to you saying, I repent, you shall forgive him. It doesn't say restore with him if indeed he is dangerous to you or a threat in that way. It doesn't say that you shall turn and bond to him if he is not truly sincere and willing to change. But forgiveness is something to keep our heart pure. How can we walk into the Passover not having forgiven in our lives? God says, I won't forgive you if you won't forgive them. And how do we know if we've forgiven or if we haven't? Well, just think about that person or that thing or that circumstance. Does it still irritate you? Does it still bring pain? Chances are, if it does, then you haven't forgiven. When it's more neutral in your mind, even though we might still have to make certain wise decisions in the course of how we choose to interact, but when it's more neutral in our own mind in terms of our emotional response, then the chances are much better that indeed forgiveness has truly taken place. The apostles said, the Lord, increase our faith. They said, I can't hardly believe that. I can't hardly believe you would expect us to reach that level. And you know what? It's like that individual I mentioned that was saying, well, you know, I don't think I can do all these things. And I said, well, I don't think you can either. But you can with Christ living in you. By yourself, you cannot. So they said, increase our faith. So the Lord said, if your faith is a mustard seed, you can say to this mulberry tree, be pulled up by the roots, be planted in the sea, and it would obey you. You know, I say, okay, let's not get hung up on the fact that we can't walk out the door and tell that tree to go somewhere else. Making an illustration that if indeed we have faith in God and submit ourselves to Him, we will indeed be able to fulfill His will. And overcoming in this flesh is much more important than landscaping that tree into another place. Standing firm before God, not against God, but by His power and going forward, is a courageous act that is done through His Holy Spirit. We need to accomplish that task. We need to be spiritually mature. Which of you having a servant plowing or tending sheep will say to him when he has come in from the field, come at once and sit down to eat? But will he not rather say to him, prepare something for my supper and gird yourself and serve me until I've eaten and drunk, and afterward you eat and drink? Does he thank that servant because he did the things that were commanded him? I think not. So likewise you, when you have done all those things which you are commanded, when you obey God according to His word, then say, we are unprofitable servants. We have done that which was our duty to do. We just did what God told us. When God works through you, you simply are responsive to Him. He has all the power of this universe and more. He created us and it. I was hoping Gail would get off into intelligent design and just throw out some more stuff, because I love that. And I appreciate it. There's a context. The intelligent design arguments are beginning to swell to the point that they are being just slapped down out of hand. Not even in some cases argued against, just mocked and derided the way prejudice is installed into, and fear is installed into relationships. It's a fascinating subject, and there's a huge exchange that is in the process of taking place. But the most that we can do is to be responsive to God. But in our heart, we should be striving to go above and beyond that which is required of us. But what God requires of us is simply to give ourselves totally and completely to Him. When God asks us for something, it's because everything we have is already His. It's hard to go above and beyond that, isn't it? If He has it all, you're just giving it back to Him. We are His as well. When God, when we give Him what we have, all we have done is our duty. It's His. Man cannot ask us for everything because man is not our master. Man can take us captive. He can force us, but He cannot truly make us His slaves. He can bind us, but we cannot be His slaves because we are slaves to God. And man cannot make us respond in that way. Romans 6 shows that this is an act of our will in response to God's call and His lead. Romans 6 and verse 16. Do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one slaves whom you obey, whether of sin to death or of obedience to righteousness? But God be thanked that though you were slaves of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered. And having been set free from sin, you became slaves of righteousness. It's talking about being in bondage to this world and to Satan, or submitting ourselves totally and completely to God. I speak in human terms because of the weakness of your flesh, for just as you presented your members as slaves of uncleanness and of the lawlessness leading to more lawlessness, so now present your members as slaves of righteousness for holiness. How many times do we walk up against the barrier and stand there and look at this large obstacle in front of us? And how many times do we have to make that call and say, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me? Doesn't matter if it's 6 foot or 12 foot or 10 feet or long or short or wide, I can do all things. Go forward in God's call. Don't pull back. We are not of those who pull back, draw back to destruction. Verse 20. For when you were slaves of sin, you were free in regard to righteousness. What fruit did you have then in the things of which you are now ashamed? What good was it to have ownership or access to those things? What has remained in your hands that is so valuable from these things that you left behind? For the end of those things is death. But now, having been set free from sin and having become slaves of God, you have your fruit to holiness and the end, everlasting life. For the wages of sin is death. The highest reward in this flesh is death. But the gift of God is eternal life in Christ Jesus, our Lord. There's a drawer at home, one of the little dressers by the side of the bed. And inside that drawer are some little tiny paper and cardboard type boxes. They hardly ever get moved. When we get moved, those boxes get moved. Don't we all have a lot of things like that? You know, we collect and accumulate and squirrel away these things from different things we've experienced and been exposed to our lives. But there's a drawer with these little boxes in it. And nobody ever goes in that drawer. I think Derek went in there once. I was in the bedroom, and I had a hunting knife sitting in there that had been given to me, and I don't use that either. But he knew it was there, so he's digging it out, and he's digging through these little boxes. You know, aside from that, I cannot consciously remember anybody even going through that. They just sit there for year after year after year after year. And someday when we get transferred, the movers will come in, and they'll load that dresser up in those contents, and we'll set it up in the next house, and there those boxes will sit. Well, I thought I would break the pattern. I don't think these boxes have ever been out of the house. In our marriage, they've probably never been out of the room, whatever they were stored in, what they were left at that time. So I thought I'd bring them in, some of the detritus of our lives. It's a Purple Heart. I always like Purple Heart. It's got George Washington on the front. It's purple and just a beautiful gold combination. You know what a Purple Heart's for? Purple Heart's for being too slow to get out of the way. You just couldn't get out of the way. I had a friend ran into a steel pipe one time on a fire base, and they gave him a Purple Heart. Had a cut on his leg. This is not for getting shot in the rear end with a piece of rice. This is the real thing. But it's Purple Heart. Never comes out of the box, never leaves the drawer, never leaves the house. This is a huge exception. This is like bringing in my Wishbone collection. You know, it's like going on Oprah and pouring out your heart to the audience. You know, here's something that never, ever leaves the drawer. I got out of the Army in 1971. This is 2005, and this thing has never been out of the house. Okay? Here's another box. It's a Bronze Star. Now, I don't know what this is for. I know what Bronze Stars are for. They're for valor. You know, the Bronze Star is coveted. If I ever run for president someday, I'll take this out, make up a big story that goes with it, you know, how I suffered forever and saved people's lives. And I don't know what this is for. I was awarded it. They never told me why. I never did anything that I thought merited one. But somebody thought I should have it, so they gave it to me. So I thought, okay, got a Bronze Star. If I ever run for president, I'm a shoo-in. It's for courage and valor, and I don't have a clue why they gave it to me. Honestly. I've often wondered. But I must not wonder too much, because it stays in my drawer. I went through there. There's other ones that are more for location or just because, you know. I looked at this one. It has a kind of a sunburst with an eagle on it and lightning in the talons. I don't even know what it is. I got that too. I don't even know what it's for. Some medal, some honors, some something. But I can't even remember. I thought, that's funny. Surely I would remember what the medal was for. You can get medals for all kinds of things in this life. And they have a measure of meaning and significance to us in a personal way. But you know what? God doesn't give out medals. They're not the real thing. You know, this Silver Star is not valor. Like they used to say, Silver Star and 2 bits, buy a cup of coffee, you know, now it's $4. You know, it's kind of where you go. That's not valor. Purple Heart's not real blood. You have to bleed, but this isn't blood. This is just token. It's not the real thing. If you got a Purple Heart, it doesn't mean you're brave. It doesn't mean you're putting your life at risk. It doesn't mean anything. It means you got a token. That's all it is. Like I said, it has significance, but only in a specific way. God doesn't give us tokens, and he doesn't want us to give tokens to him. He wants the real thing, not the representation. He doesn't want the show of maturity. He wants the actual accomplishment, the production, the fruitfulness of our Christian growth. When we go into Passover, he doesn't want us just to drink the wine and eat the bread and sit there nice and in a nice suit or a beautiful dress in some way and to be solemn. No, he wants us to be solemn in our hearts. He wants us to be the real thing. Micah chapter 6, verse number 6 talks about the real thing. Micah 6 and verse 6. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the Most High? Think he's impressed with medals and honors and certificates and memories and, boy, it used to be great, wasn't it? Look at all those things we used to do. Man, I used to be so strong. I used to not even have to exercise before I went climbing. I used to not even exercise and go climbing. Wasn't that great? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings? With calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams or 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? To do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. I would go so far as to say, and it would apply some to us, and it would probably apply some to others, if we were doing justly and loving mercy and walking humbly with God, then as a church we would not be divided. I would go so far as to say that. And let us just say, let it be some with us and maybe some with someone else. Because how can I judge where all of that responsibility lies? Let us judge ourselves, our own attitude, our own approach, our own hearts. The God says, don't give me tokens. Don't give me images. Give me your heart. Let me change you to be like me. Why don't you take on the fullness of the measure of the stature of Christ? Why don't you try doing that? Romans 12, verse number 1. I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice. See, you cannot go above and beyond what God asks us to do because he asks us to do it all. But he says, I will do it through you. But you have to be responsive to me in that way. Present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. Do not be conformed to this world. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable in the perfect will of God. God says, I'll take it all. It's mine anyway. And anything you've got or done or accomplished, I gave it to you and worked with you and led you and gave you strength. I got a call this week. Someone asked me, people ask me why the president, in the United States of God is being changed. Not a minister calling me. A minister wouldn't call and ask me that question. But people ask me why the presidency is being changed. And I really don't know what to say. What would I say? I said, well, you just tell them because we can. That sounds kind of cheeky, doesn't it? Because we can. But then I said, being led by different men is a strength, not a weakness. Being able to have different leaders and continue on the same course with the same goals and ideals is not a weakness. It is a strength. We are not dependent on the leadership of an individual. We are only dependent on God. So I thank Roy Holiday and his wife Norma for the sacrifice they have made and the leadership they have given. I believe it is more courageous to step down than to step up. They have shown more courage in the end than they did in the beginning, by necessity, but they have done so. And I'll tell you what, wherever they go, it'll be a blessing to whomever they serve. I'd just like to have them come into an area here and begin to teach. It'd be a remarkable blessing because of who they are. Be strong. Go forward. That is the way that we must live. I leave Tuesday morning for Nigeria, and as I said, unfortunately, my time is already gone. If you need something, Terry will indeed fulfill that responsibility. If you're in Kennewick, Joe will be behind me and back me up and assist me, and frankly, they replace me because they do it on their own, in their own service and the calling that they have. I'm glad and I'm grateful to them for the responsibility they take in my absence. And I will say this, I am deeply grateful in the congregations for the responsibilities you take when I am here. Because again, when you're doing things because you want to and because you choose to and not because someone told you or made you, you go above and beyond. That is what this Christian life is all about. I hope the spring holy days go well for you. I hope all of us attain more that fullness of the measure of the stature of Jesus Christ. I hope we grow and overcome in ways that are significant and important, obviously, before God. And I do hope that these holy days, these times, help us all to become more spiritually mature.